Thank you very much for having me. Oh, I don't want to trip over this. So I'm going to be talking about some recent and ongoing work that I've been doing in terms of improving sensitivity to hidden sector particles, particularly at particle colliders, both low energy intensity frontier experiments as well as high energy experiments. And this will be very brief in terms of motivation, but we expect that there exists new physics that we could class under the term hidden sector, meaning that it couples in some sense that's very weakly to the standard model. So for instance, for neutrinos, they have very small but non-zero mass. So in order to avoid over-contributing to neutrino masses, perhaps either you have new states that are very heavy or are just very weakly coupled to us. Similarly, the matter-antimatter asymmetry, there's a condition for generating the correct asymmetry that things need to be out of equilibrium, which again suggests processes that are slow compared to typical rates in the standard model. And so once again, pointing towards weak coupling. And then finally, we have dark matter, which we have no idea what it is. We just know that we haven't seen it in any of its particle interactions. And what's interesting about all of these motivations is that there's no definitive mass scale for where the new physics has to be. And so we want to think very broadly about what kinds of experiments we should be doing to look for them. And you know, the thermal dark matter story is very common one to talk about. We have some new particle that couples the standard model and is in thermal equilibrium, and then you get the correct abundance just from its thermal relic. And typically we talk about WIMPs that are in the GeV to TeV or tens of GeV to TeV range in masses. But of course, the thermal story works over a much broader range of masses. And the smaller a mass you go, the more weakly coupled you need to be. And so there are some well-defined targets for what the cross-section should be of dark matter interacting with us, and maybe that points towards the existence of some hidden sector. And this has been known for a very long time, but if the dark matter mass goes too low, if you try to couple it to standard model particles through the electroweak interactions, it's just insufficient to explain the observed abundance. You get too much dark matter. And so you basically have to have some new force, some new mediator that couples the standard model. And as soon as we start talking about, well, I have a particle and a force, then maybe there are multiple particles or multiple forces. Maybe there might be some structure to hidden sector that analogous to what we have in the standard model. And the kinds of couplings that we're looking for are products of couplings over mass squareds of like 10 to the minus 9 over GeV squared. So these are small, but they are not super small. We have experiments where you have 10 to the 20 protons on target, or you're collecting inverse autobarns of data might be sufficient to look for something that happens very rarely at low energies. So the examples of hidden sectors that get a lot of press are, in some sense, the simplest ones that we can imagine. You add a new particle to the standard model that's a singlet, and you just look at what the lowest dimensional operators are that have it interact with the standard model. So the most common examples of mediator particles are the dark photon, where I have some new gauge boson couples to the photon via some particle that's charged between both of them, and you get a kinetic mixing. And essentially, the charge of the dark photon to standard model fermions is proportional to, at low energies, the electric charge of that particle. So it's something where I add a mass of some new massive particle. I have some parameter epsilon, which parameterizes the relative strength of interaction or the mixing between the visible and dark photon. And then once I specify those two numbers, I get a complete prediction for all of the couplings in the theory. So I can just calculate those things, and that allows me to very simply study the phenomenology of this hidden sector. Similarly, for if I have a new scalar, then it generically will mix with the Higgs boson. There will be some quartic interaction. And when these fields get VEVs, or if it's a real scalar, you can just have a cubic interaction. This leads to a mixing between the scalar phi and the Higgs. And once again, what we get is a mass for the scalar, some mixing parameter that gives you an overall strength for how much it couples with the standard model. But then because it talks via the Higgs, it the strength instead of being the electric charge, it's the mass of the fermion. So once again, once I specify the mixing and the mass, I just completely determine all of the couplings. And so I can then study the phenomenology and see what we find. So these are compelling because they kind of are one or two numbers. It's easy to show plots for what the parameter space looks like. And so essentially they give very predictive messages about where we should be looking for these particles. So for instance, if I have a dark photon, it couples via electric charge. So if I'm colliding electrons or quarks, then I can produce it and it will then decay, for instance, back into standard model particles. or if I have a scalar, anytime I have like a top quark showing up somewhere, I get some huge enhancement of the rate because of the fact that I get this, you know, mass of the fermion showing up. So there's kind of a few simple probes that we can use to look at for studying these scenarios. So what have we found in terms of evidence for hidden sectors? I'll start with the optimistic slide, which is that there are some discrepancies between the expectation of the standard model in certain precision observables and what's actually seen in experiments. The most famous of these, of course, is the muon G minus 2, the fact that it's about 4 standard deviations discrepant between the theoretical and experimental observation. It could be an error in the theory or in our estimate of what the theory uncertainty is. But it could also be that there's some new interaction that couples to muons that's modifying its properties. Perhaps the largest discrepancy and one of the hardest to resolve is the proton charge radius problem, where depending on whether you're looking at the proton charge radius in muonic hydrogen versus regular hydrogen versus electron scattering, you find that in muonic hydrogen, there's, even though it's a very precise probe, it's really far off from what the other.
There has been progress.
Yes, no, I know.
It's changed.
So, as with most of these things, they're probably not real. But, it at least maybe is some room where there we can accommodate new physics effects. And then there's the kind of ongoing questions about flavor anomalies and the angular distributions of B decay star mu mu, ratios of B decay mu mu over B decay EE, similarly the ratios of B to D tau nu over B to D mu nu that show various things at the kind of 3 to 4 sigma level. And once again, if you actually try to fit all of these things, it's extremely difficult. And so, and probably, even if we're extremely lucky, one of them might be a sign of new physics. But it kind of points towards maybe there's something interesting going on with leptons, maybe something going on that's interesting for low mass states. When we actually try to look directly for the existence of these particles, it becomes a much kind of darker tale where basically we have not seen any positive evidence for these minimal hidden sectors that you might think could explain some of these scenarios. So for instance, the muon G minus 2 band for the dark photon case is this green band, and all the shaded regions are exclusions, and it's completely excluded. And so these come from a variety of different probes, E plus E minus colliders, meson decay experiments, beam dump experiments. But because even though these experiments are doing different things, you can all tie them into this single mass and single coupling. You can make this very simple plot. There is still, of course, a lot of parameter space for this model that could still be viable. But this is taken from the 2016 dark sectors report. And again, these lines are always evolving a little bit. But the basic story is that in the next 5 or so years, we expect to cover a lot of the parameter space of these models. So this is something that's well studied and is going to be studied experimentally and should continue to be studied experimentally. So this is in the simplest case where I have just a dark photon and nothing else, and it decays into standard model particles. You can also say, well, if our original motivation was dark matter, I could have a dark photon that instead of decaying visibly, decays invisibly. Then you have a lot fewer constraints, but they are still powerful. So the G minus 2 favored region is this band. Babar last year put out a result that excludes everything above this line, completely ruling out the G minus 2 preferred region.
Is it a solid result?
Pardon me?
Is it a solid result?
Oh yeah, uh-huh. Very solid. Yeah. We can talk more about it later, but
do you work on that result?
No, but I've given sort of approved talks on it. So I've gone through the materials and whatnot. And yeah, I would say there are certain regions of the selection where there are no events at low missing mass.
Okay.
So, if we saw something, maybe you wouldn't be able to tell whether it was a background or a signal, but we don't see anything. So then you can get into quibbles of maybe the Monte Carlo isn't really correctly estimating the signal efficiency, but those effects are pretty small. So I'd say that this is pretty strong result. Yeah. There's like one excess at 6 GeV, which is like this little bump here, but it's like 2.5 sigma or something.
Is the assumption here on the branching fraction to invisible? 100%. 100%.
So of course you can have some interpolation, but if I change this by a factor of square root of 2, it's probably still excluded except for maybe the most marginal region. But that this is a loophole in these sort of simplified model type scenarios where I just assume 100% branching is that you can maybe dilute things by having a lot of different weird decays or something. But what's key to this is that all of this rests upon these minimal assumptions of like how you're producing it, how it decays, and what the correlations between all of those couplings are. So this is for the dark photon. We can do a similar thing for the dark scalar. And again, there has been some progress on these things, but I pulled these plots out of a paper that Gordon made because they kind of nicely show the complementarity of different constraints in the visibly decaying mediator and invisibly decaying mediator case. In order to explain muon G minus 2, the coupling would have to be like way up here. So and that's just because the muon has a small mass. So that's like completely excluded in these scenarios.
You can't even do it, right? I mean, like it's through the mixing.
Yeah.
Mixing has to be order
one. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. That band would be like here.
Old paper by Marciano and Kinoshita is that if the Higgs mass is like 200 MeV, shift in G minus 2 is plus like 3 times 10 minus 9.
Yeah. But that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, too bad, yeah. But the point is in sort of rare B-meson decays, in rare meson decays, you can see constraints on the mixing squares of order 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 8. Again, just because you tend to get these large enhancements to the top coupling, and this gives you, flavor-changing processes and whatnot. Similarly, in the invisibly decaying case, you get rare decays and you get constraints from the invisible branching fraction of the Higgs and so on. So, again, there's progress that's going to be made in various experiments, but there's already fairly good coverage. So what is there to do? Are we just kind of ending the period of interest in Higgs actors? I think that the answer is no. And what's picked up a lot of steam over the past 5 or 7 years as these constraints have come up is, how confident are we that we really have a single vector that has a single mixing and that completely determines its phenomena? And so for instance, if I turn off the coupling of this A prime to electrons, then suddenly I don't get this E plus E minus production of A primes in low energy plus E minus colliders that's so constraining. Similarly, if this scalar just doesn't talk to top quarks, then, you can talk about whether model building, you're always going to induce it at some level, but if you can suppress it sufficiently, all these flavor changing interactions get suppressed, and then those constraints aren't super strong anymore. And there are several examples of these. So for instance, a kind of heavy flavor leptophilic gauge boson, like something that couples to L mu minus L tau, that has a suppressed coupling to electrons, or you could have a gauged U1R symmetry for the muons. Which you need to UV complete in some way, but in principle you can have these things. You can have leptophilic scalars that you suppress the coupling to quarks, and this would then turn off a lot of the constraints we have. Maxime had a proposal for this recently. There's also a different proposal out of a group at Brookhaven. You could imagine where you only couple to gauge bosons and not to fermions at all, or at least at leading order. And that will basically suppress the kinds of signals that people have been looking at. And these are not necessarily, some of them are contrived, some of them are not contrived. So we want to see what can we do to improve sensitivity to both sort of slight extensions as well as just think about what new signatures that we could have that could be being missed. So what I'm going to talk about in the first part is particularly work that I've been doing with Babar, where I've been involved in several experimental analyses, basically looking at their data for evidence of these other hidden sector type particles in both the case of these leptophilic forces as well as in axion-like particles, and then some ongoing work where I'm starting to think about what can we be doing in terms of long-lived particles that's a little bit more generic than some of the highly targeted searches that have been done at B factories. And then I'll talk a little bit about what we might be able to do with the LHC, where the LHC seems like it's overkill for low mass hidden sectors because you don't necessarily need that much energy, but it could be that the production portal for the low mass hidden sector is a very massive state, and so you need LHC energies to get it. And this could be true from decays of W, Z, Higgs, Z primes, and this kind of thing. And so then the question is, how do we tease out these very subtle signals in a very complicated hadronic environment where you have collisions happening at very high energies? So to start with, let's look at what we can be doing with Babar, and then kind of looking forward to Bell 2 of extending this search for hidden sectors. So let's say that we wanted, we saw a bunch of anomalies that seem to be affecting muons and heavy flavor stuff. So let's say we want to probe that in a model-independent way. We want to try to avoid making as many assumptions as possible, or rather to make as few assumptions as possible. So for, as an example, if I have a Z prime that couples to L mu minus L tau, then I couple to mus and taus and neutrinos, and then other couplings only come in at loop level and are suppressed. Now this has its own set of constraints, which Maxime and collaborators here derived in terms of these neutrino trident processes, which are mediated by a Z prime and would show up at neutrino experiments. So this is the muon G minus 2 band here. It's blue in this plot. Here are reinterpretations of neutrino experiments looking for this neutrino trident process. So you can see that it's ruled out sort of at the 500, 600 MeV level. And of course, this is always a theorist interpretation of experimental results, so you kind of put some little error bar associated with that in it. But there's some chunk of parameter spaces available at lower mass. And even this, even though this is a fairly modest assumption, assumes that this particle also couples to neutrinos. And you might have, for instance, a scalar that doesn't couple to neutrinos but does couple to muons, or you have a Z prime that only talks to the right-handed muons. You could have something where these processes are suppressed. So what is something that we can do? Well, if I want to probe the coupling to muons, then in colliders, I produce a ton of muons. And so I can radiate off the new particle through final state radiation. So I get something like E plus E minus goes to a pair of muons plus a Z prime, which then decays into muons. So I got a 4-muon final state, two of which reconstruct the invariant mass of the Z prime. And the cross sections, so let's say I take an L mu minus L tau model, I can say if I want to explain the muon G minus 2 band, what are the production cross sections times branching fractions? And they're in the like 0.3 to few femtobarn range. And this is for collisions at 10 GeV center of mass energy of the electron and positron. Babar has 500 inverse femtobarns. So we expect to have order 100 or hundreds of events. And so this is something that's definitely doable in a low energy collider, even though the couplings are very small. So I basically joined Babar to do the search. And so what we did was we looked for this striking signature, which is that I have 4 muons which take up the entire beam energy. And the dominant background is just going to be the same process, but with an off-shell photon. And you can see this. This is a plot of the 4-muon invariant mass. The red is the QED 4-muon production. You can see that if I require the full beam energy, I'm basically completely dominated by this.
So what's how many 4-muon pairs overall there
are? Like 10 to the 5? Something like that, yeah. We'll see some plots of, but yeah, you can kind of read here, it's about 10 to the 5, right? They're great.
This is only requiring the beam energy constraint.
No, so the beam energy constraint is basically requiring right here. So this is the invariant mass of the 4 muons. So what you can see is that we have a, at low mass, you're dominated by taus, mm-hmm. where you're mis-IDing some of the pions as muons and stuff like that. And then, yeah, you have these peaking backgrounds, but it's dominantly just QED. You can also see from this plot that ISR is not included at either our signal or background Monte Carlo, so we have to correct for that. And basically, we found that the backgrounds are actually low enough that we want to keep as many signal events as possible. So we actually only apply particle ID to the same sine muon. So we require either 2 mu pluses or 2 mu minuses. And then the others can be whatever. You got some pion contamination, but it's low enough that it doesn't actually matter. And that increases our sensitivity. So this is what the invariant mass spectrum looks like, or rather this something called the reduced dimuon mass, which is m mu mu squared minus 4 m mu squared. It's regularized so that it goes to zero at zero is where the kinematic threshold is. And so the red is the Monte Carlo prediction for QED. There are ISR effects which push a bunch of things off of the peak, which is why this is systematically low. But you can see that the shape is relatively good, except in a few places. So you see some broad bump here from the rho meson, and then you see contributions from the J psi here.
Rho meson, so there are 4 muons, right? Mm-hmm. So rho contributes to one pair, or?
Yeah, so I think it's often rho to pi pi, and then you have a mis-ID of one of the pions, and then you get a pair of muons from something else as the dominant contribution. But the rho is very broad, order hundreds of MeV. The mass resolution that we have is order MeV. And so actually, we don't even need to try and remove the rho or any or fit it separately. It gets just part of the continuum background. The only actual resonance that we can see is the J psi. And so what we do is we just don't look in that region. And in that region, we include in the background component a bump corresponding to the J psi. No, it doesn't contribute enough to this. Yeah. So I mean, the miss ID rate is improbable enough that like it's not a major source of background. We kind of had a list of things that we maybe would be concerned about, but yeah, none of them really. I mean, it's quite easy. Basically, you just run your algorithm, and then you will like discover a particle at the mass of one of these other things, and then you say, okay, it's showing up. I need to remove it. Of course, we would never believe the discovery of a Z prime that has the same mass as a phi. So we're not that optimistic yet. Okay, so basically what we end up with is a smooth background, which we model with a polynomial, and then the signal is modeled from Monte Carlo as a peak. And so we take the signal spectrum from Monte Carlo, and we validate it on the J psi. It seems to do a reasonable job. And basically, we're completely dominated by statistical uncertainty. So this is the result. This is the best fit signal cross section. And this is the statistical significance of the event. You can see that we don't really see any main outliers. There's one here that's like a 4 sigma local, but it's only like 1.6 global. So we don't see any excess. And so we can interpret this as limits on the cross section. So we provide a model-independent cross-section on the limit of order 0.2 to 0.4 femtobarns.
So you already built in the branching of Z prime to mu mu?
And for this, model? Yes. So this is a model that's just on the, you know, the cross-section of the signal process. And then in interpreting it in the theory, so this doesn't really require any theory input except for the shape of the signal and the kinematics. This is where you actually get the rate by, you know, solving for what value of G prime corresponds to this. You can see that we essentially rule out, you know, confirm the results of the neutrino trident experiment, rule out the last corner of parameter space here. And because we provided this model independent thing, you can also take and apply it to other scenarios. So we didn't look at this in the paper, but I could take, for instance, a model where I couple the Z prime to the right-handed muon. It contributes the wrong sign to G minus 2. So you can't be up here and still be consistent with the measurement, but it provides the best sensitivity. So this is kind of the best probe that we have of things that talk exclusively or predominantly to muons. And in some of the models of flavor anomalies, these searches also apply. So it's kind of nice that with one stone, we can kill a lot of birds. So what about if we take a similar model, except instead of, you know, I just say, okay, my mediator talks only to muons. But instead of a vector, I have a scalar. Well, it turns out that the cross-section that you get is substantially reduced relative to that of a vector to explain mu on g minus 2, just because the scalar contributes more to g on mu on g minus 2, so it has a smaller coupling that contributes to it. And also, there's fewer degrees of freedom that you're producing. And so that lowers the cross-section.
It's
so
just numerical factors.
It's numerical factors. There's no fundamental factors. It's like there's two factors of three or two that come in and knock you down. You know, unfortunately, experimentally, there's a big difference between 500 inverse femtobarns and, you know, 5 inverse attobarns, even though, you know, these are small numerical factors in the calculation. So basically, the moral of the story is our search, which has its best sensitivity sort of here, kind of grazes the muon g minus 2 line if it's a scalar, but not actually covering it. However, there might be some advantage to, you know, that we can basically consider a next to minimal model where I have something that predominantly interacts with muons, but also interacts with heavy flavor like leptons like taus. So for instance, if I have a mass proportional coupling like standard model Higgs is expected to have, then suddenly your production, if you make it off taus, is enhanced by m tau squared or m mu squared, and now we're suddenly in the tens of femtobarn, you know, orders of thousands of events. So what kind of a model can we do? Once again, Maxine to the rescue has this model of, basically it's a leptophilic two Higgs doublet model plus a singlet, and when you mix the singlet in, it acquires a mass proportional coupling predominantly to leptons and suppressed to quarks. And if you take...
I should apologize for this model. We started writing it at the moment when the Higgs discovery was announced and CMS bravely put out the branching of Higgs to tau tau being zero. Right? And we thought, oh, great, that we can explain that. And while we were writing it,
they migrated up.
their answer, their analysis was just this 2012 analysis was just wrong, right? Mm. And so on the next iteration, they started seeing it, and where we already did so much calculation that we still had to go ahead with the paper.
Yeah, so you know, something that's interesting about this model, though, is it's an example of something that can contribute to the muon G minus 2 and is basically not ruled out by any experimental constraints. Mm-hmm. And so whether you like this UV model or not, you know, when you match it onto some IR model, here's the search that I was just talking about, and as you can see, it grazes the line, but it doesn't actually cover it.
So how do you interpret this plot? Like, it looks like the top barbar line is living off just the muon coupling, and the bottom one lives off the mixing.
So this is the projection, yeah, that they did if you radiate off of taus like this. It's optimistic, but it's actually not so bad. Yeah, I mean, the thing that matters is that you cover the green band, and we're sort of. Well, I have to watch what I say on video, but we're fairly confident that we can cover the green band. Here is actually where it's hard, and unfortunately, I got stuck with this part of the analysis. So we could talk about that later if you want. So the idea is you produce a tau pair, you radiate it off a scalar, it decays into two leptons. Because it has a mass proportional coupling, it's going to decay into the heaviest leptons that are kinematically allowed. So if this phi is above the muon mass, it decays to two muons. If it's above the below the muon mass, it decays to E plus E minus. Above the tau mass, you're basically just hosed. And so we're still doing the search to mu plus mu minus and just paying the small branching fraction penalty because you know that's the best thing that we can do. So what you get is a dileptron resonance in association with single track tau decays, which are most of the tau decays, and it by requiring a single track, you suppress a lot of the strong interaction backgrounds. And what's especially interesting is that if this can't decay to muons and it has to decay to electrons, because Me is so small, you actually have that this thing is long-lived and has a lifetime on the order of centimeter or so, which is kind of in the sweet spot of what we're able to do. It's also in the sweet spot of looking exactly like a photon conversion, which adds its own set of concerns, but this is currently an internal review of the collaboration, so we hope to have a result not too distant future. So that's some progress on this direction of what happens if you have things that don't just couple predominantly to electrons and you get tons of constraints from electron beams. What if I have other types of signatures? So for instance, we can consider searches for axion-like particles, which for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to define as something which is a pseudo-Goldstone of an anomalous global symmetry, and it couples predominantly to pairs of standard model gauge bosons. It also can, depending on the specifics of the model, mix with the Higgs and give you a direct coupling to standard model fermions, but you know that depends on what the UV charges of these things are. But kind of the thing that's most distinctive about this is this coupling to pairs of gauge bosons. And if the main effect is mixing with fermions, then it just looks kind of like a dark Higgs type state. So this is what we focused on. And what we get is this dimensionful coupling, which is proportional to you know some UV parameters of the model. But essentially, we can simplify our parameterization in terms of this one coupling. And because this couples primarily to two bosons, then the axion-like particle decays to pairs of bosons, especially at low masses, it decays to a pair of photons. And so this is an example of a plot which is taken from a paper. These constraints have actually been slightly improved because CMS actually did a search for axion-like particles in heavy ion collisions. But this is a paper from Simon, Tong Yan, and various people at Berkeley who proposed using the huge electric fields around heavy ions that you have photons from those that collide and basically can produce axion-like particles. And this was their kind of projection of what you could do with it. These are constraints from existing colliders, beam dumps. It sort of looks similar to what we have already. What's kind of interesting in this plot is that there's this gap region here, which is often filled in by flavor constraints.
This is because the B factories were not analyzed.
Correct, yeah.
That's all.
Mm-hmm.
So told Simon.
Yeah. So they did have some constraint. What were you thinking of the B decay?
Well, you could have no. What I meant is that you can have gamma production of ops at
Yes. Yeah.
We had some weird model with like Pine and Post.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I remember.
So that one has to like generalize it to
act as a mass. Yeah, exactly.
A lot of probe and that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's where we're going. But you know, there's a lot that can be done here. So we are interested in studying this. So the particular probe that we were interested in is the fact that you know, one of the most sensitive probes of new particles in the GV mass range is production from flavor-changing meson decays. And you know, these are typically assumed, well, if I have some large coupling to tops, I can emit the particle here, and I get a flavor-changing decay. But if you couple the Ws, you can also emit it off the W line. So what you'll end up with is something like a B quark decaying to a strange quark, emitting an axion-like particle. And so you'll get something like B decay, axion, axion to gamma, gamma. And this is something that hasn't actually been looked for, in part because the standard model rate for B decay, gamma, gamma is so low that a lot of the experiments were like, we don't really have a hope of measuring that anyway. But because we have a resonance here, it greatly improves the sensitivity. So there's a few different ways you can go with this. One is that you could say, you know, well, let's say that this axion-like particle is a mediator to dark matter and decays invisibly. Then you essentially have two production modes at B factories. One is through this rare B and K decays. So this is, we reinterpreted the Babar B decay plus invisible search, where they provide things binned in the missing mass squared. And you can see that the constraint from the flavor probe far surpasses a constraint from the kind of reinterpretation of the invisible dark photon search, where what you have is you have an off-shell photon which goes to photon, axion, axion goes to invisible. Similarly, if we go down to sufficiently low masses, then you can produce it in kaon decays, and then you have a really stringent constraint. And if you interpret this in terms of you know, the mass scale that we're probing, you know, we're probing masses you know, before you take into account loop factors of hundreds of TeV, thousands of TeV. After you take into account loop factors, it's still well above the weak scale. So you're really hitting this kind of high energy regime. So this is just some searches that have been done already. There hasn't been a search for B to K, axion, axion, gamma, gamma. But there are searches for measurements of the branching fraction of B to K pi zero, or pi zero to gamma, gamma, which is exactly the same, sort of like Maxime was saying, you just generalize the search for different masses. And this branching fraction is measured with 10 to the minus 6 level precision. And so we made an estimate of what part of the parameter space could we cover in the model with a 10 to the minus 6 branching fraction. This is the LEP constraint, these are the beam dump constraints, these are the kaon constraints. So you can see that we have several orders of magnitude in the coupling that can potentially be improved upon. Yeah?
It's expressed in the standard model, this branching fraction B to K pi. And we wouldn't expect it to be so small, or not? Is there something?
I mean, it's a flavor changing neutral current process. And it's, I mean, it's not that small, it's like 10 to the minus 5, a few times 10 to the minus 5. But then it's measured at the 10 to the minus 6 level. So what we're interested in is the uncertainty or the precision at which it can measure it. So I mean, we do get a lot of these events in our sample, but yeah.
Oh, well, B is mostly decays to
D's, yeah.
Right? I mean, so whenever you have only light flavor in the decay, that's...
yeah, the double CKM suppression. There's also something.
Even some puzzles in this K pi channel.
Yes. Yeah. There's. Yeah. You was saying something
so
about
like
that.
Like CPU violation doesn't match, but this is like the description is pretty bad. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But we, in this case, we actually get you know, the standard model. You have a B to S gamma, but this is a higher dimensional operator because of, you know, you have some dipole coupling. And so what this actually goes like, you know, mb squared over the cutoff, whereas this goes like mb over the cutoff. Mb squared over the cutoff squared. So you get an extra enhancement of this signal relative to like naive flavor changing photon production. And then this curve was our projection of what B factories could do in this model looking for basically three photon production, where you produce, again, an off-shell photon, and an axion, off-shell photon goes to photon, axion, axion goes to two photons. And depending on the relative coupling to the W boson and hypercharge, you know, these lines shift up and down relative to one another, but this is kind of the basic gist that you get. The lower lines are some projections for what might be possible at Bell 2. Again, without giving too much away, I think this curve is certainly doable above R. and potentially even better, we would hope. So this could even be an even more sensitive probe than we had expected. Of course, we have to mask out the diphoton residences pi 0, eta, and eta prime. And then things get a little bit tricky down at low mass because the lifetime starts getting long. And so that's something that we're still kind of working on worrying about. This is a search that we're doing at Harvey Mudd with two undergraduate students of mine. And basically, we're using some multivariate analysis techniques to separate out the different background components. And we expect it to be a very low background search. So stay tuned for more information on this, hopefully in the near future. Finally, these are kind of motivated by specific gaps that have been identified in coverage. Another thing that is challenging to do at low energy colliders are long-lived particle searches. And you know, what could we be missing? Well, hidden sectors, especially if you have GV mass particles, they tend to have long lifetimes, you know, longer than a millimeter or so. The B factories have excellent vertex resolution because you want to identify the decay vertices of the B and char mesons and things like this. However, there are actually only a few long-lived particle searches at B factories. So Babar has perhaps the most generic search, which is that it looks for a single long-lived particle which undergoes a two-body decay to leptons or mesons. This is fully reconstructed. And so you basically look for the mass of this long-lived particle in some pair of leptons or pair of mesons. And that's quite constraining if you happen to have a decay to mu plus, mu minus or something. There's the dark leptophilic scalar that we're doing now, which is in the context I'm looking for a long-lived particle decaying to e plus, e minus in association with taus. And then there's a search looking for Majorana neutrinos produced in semi-leptonic B decays, where instead of producing a left-handed neutrino, you make a right-handed neutrino, and then it decays to lepton pion. But again, it's a very like exclusive process. They're looking for the lepton from the semi-leptonic B decay, as well as for this very specific lepton pion state. So there could, in principle, be a lot of things that are hiding here, and even in the searches that we've been doing, that you would lose sensitivity as if the decay length is longer than, say, 5 to 10 centimeters, and more if they require the whatever particle is emerging from the beam spot. At high energy colliders as motivation, there are typically more inclusive searches for long-lived particles because the backgrounds tend to be quite low. And so then the statement is, well, instead of requiring I need exactly one lepton or two tracks on the tau plus this other thing, maybe we can look for a spectacular enough signature that we don't need to impose all sorts of additional constraints on to generalize the model. And so this is just a motivational plot. This is assuming I have a dark photon, which is kinetically mixed and decays into two particles chi, which are long-lived particles. And on the mass, and I say, okay, let's impose some relationship between the mass of the dark photon and the mass of the chi, and ask, let's say I want to be sensitive to like 40 events at Bell 2, which would be like 10 signal events plus, with a 25% efficiency. And you can see that depending on the mass and lifetime, you can actually get sensitivity to kinetic mixings of order 10 to the minus 5, which is extremely small. And that's just because if these events have a low background, the kind of searches we've been talking about have very low background, you don't really need a lot of events to actually see something or rule it out. And this plot is assuming that we require the decay of the particle to be between 0.5 and 30 centimeters of the interaction point in the transverse direction. Currently, with Nikita, we're working on what's some minimal set of production decay modes that are interesting to look for, both kind of from the theory side, but also giving different signatures. Like you could get four leptons, you could get higher track multiplicities, and you could get pairs of them, and that could be used to suppress backgrounds if you're trying to do a more inclusive search. So the goal is to kind of bring this program down into lower energy colliders so that we can cover more territory with fewer searches as well.
Is it possible go back to Babar and Bell data to do the same?
Sure, yeah. I mean, if enough people are able to do the searches. absolutely. Bell is easier because they have, they have an updated framework, but they have brought all of their data into the updated framework. So for them, it will be relatively not difficult to access their old data. But Babar, once it like completely shutters, it's going to be much harder. People are talking about keeping things going until 2022, which is perhaps a bit optimistic, but that would be kind of the time scale. So there's certainly time if we have something interesting to do for Babar, we could do it, but Bell 2 certainly. I think what's interesting about this is that if I have a dark photon that decays into long-lived particles, you have to look for the long-lived particle to discover the dark photon, unless the lifetime is very long, in which case you enter the kind of missing energy visible dark photon regime. But this may be the way you have to look for it to discover it. And it may just not be turning up because we haven't done the searches yet.
What's
so,
the displacement for the LHC?
What do you mean?
Well, quark anti-quark giving you like a pair of these long particles.
Oh, I see. If I took the same lifetime and then I boosted them to the LHC.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they're much more boosted.
Yes. Yeah. So you typically end up with meters or longer.
Which is not necessarily good.
Well, it could be. It depends on what the signal is, but you know, and it could show up in Methuselah, for instance. But yeah. So I mean, epsilons of 10 to the minus 5 are just like hard to do. I mean, we kind of looked at some of these. You know, you have a Z prime that decays into stale neutrinos, and you know, I think we were seeing couplings of order 10 to the minus 4. So this is kind of pushing down even a little bit more. But certainly, you know. And I'll get to this in a moment, you have to ask the questions of the kind of complementarity of these different probes, which is not fully worked out. I mean, we haven't fully worked out what we want to do with the B factories yet anyway, so yeah. I mean, part of this is the challenge of modeling. If I have something that decays hadronically and its mass is 1.5 GeV, it's a real pain in the butt. So what are some ways that we can try and characterize these things such that we're not picking up on supermodel dependent features of how we're doing the hadronization or whatnot? And then just as an example of kind of a newish search that Babar just put out, there's this, it just came out this past month, this kind of sexa-quark state that has been subject to some discussion in the community, but could be produced in upsilon to hexa-quark lambda-bar, lambda-bar. And whether or not you think that this basically, it could be a tightly bound six-quark state, and whether you think it exists or not is kind of an interesting signature to look for.
This is Glennis's model?
Yes.
I see.
Well, I mean, this isn't a model. This is just something you can look for, right? I mean, well, it's sort of some interesting flavor structure. It applies quite generally to the existing. It doesn't have to be a hexa-quark. It could be a scalar that couples through some higher-dimensional operator to this kind of flavored state.
So it's, the idea is that it's... a very tightly packed and stable UDS.
Mm-hmm. But this search doesn't require that. I mean, you could imagine you have some scalar that couples to a pair, UDS essentially. You get
so
the same thing.
12 e plus or minus to 12 quarks.
Well, yeah. So you have, an upsilon, decaying to pairs of UDS. Yeah. And it's an example of sort of a funny flavor signal that has very low background in principle. You could see something there. And so Bertrand was sort of the leader of this search and was able to basically constrain such signals to very, very small branching fractions. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes or so, I want to talk about the LHC.
Just for myself. Are they like the four baryon states? Are they observed in the case of upsilons? Like, instead of this S, which is basically a tight bound state of two baryons, right? Could I have like lambda 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 bar lambda bar? Is that the observer?
I actually don't know. I can look that up. Yep.
I thought it would be small.
I think it's not. Whether this is a realistic.
Branching, is it ever constraining, right?
Yeah.
You can ask the question, well, all right, upsilon decays to, helium-4, helium-4.
Well, sure.
What's the probability? You can probably.
Yeah, of course.
Good constraint, but it's it's not telling.
Sure. I think that the point of this slide is more just to motivate the fact that there are things that are relatively simple to look at, and if you have a good motivation, without commenting on the quality of motivations. However, it's also a comment on the persistence that someone pulls in twisting the arm of the experimentalist. So if you have a good idea, you should be twisting my arm or other people's arms, because that's how resources get allocated. Okay. So LHC is, if we're interested in like what can we do with hidden sectors of the LHC, the challenges are very different. So at Babar, it was very clean, and it was more about identifying features of the signals that we could use to separate it from whatever, you know, photon conversion or whatever backgrounds we have. At the LHC, you have a much more basic problem, which is that I'm trying to produce some GV mass particles, and it's a, you know, 14 TeV collider. So like, for instance, how are you going to even pass the trigger? You know, if I just make some GV stuff, well, every collision makes some GV stuff. And typically, if you're producing low mass stuff, it's going to be quite boosted as well. So there may be additional opportunities, like maybe there's some associated production of other objects or something that we can use to either pass the trigger or help select on these interesting events. So one way you can go is to just boost whatever it is so that you pass whatever kinematic selection you have. The other is that you can try and make it a sufficiently spectacular event that the QCD backgrounds are low enough you can trigger on it directly. And one example of those is if I have a high multiplicity of soft particles that come from the decay of hidden sector particles, like 8 muons, 6 muons, 10 muons. These are things that just don't, or at least happen very rarely in the kinds of processes that are happening at the LHC. So where might you be able to get this from a simple model that we could try and study in a comprehensive way? Well, let's revisit this dark photon model. I have a dark photon that kinetically mixes with the photon or the Z. The dark photon inherits essentially a coupling proportional to electric charge. But we could imagine that this dark gauge symmetry is Higgs, and that's what is responsible for the mass of the dark gauge boson. And in this case, the mass generation mechanism gives rise to a new interaction, which is a dark photon, dark photon, dark Higgs. And so you can, just like you look for Higgs-Shillung in standard model processes, you can look for a dark Higgs-Shillung. And this is something that was proposed at B-factories by Maxime and company and done in searches at Babar and Bell. And actually, they're incredibly powerful, that depending on what this dark coupling is, it can surpass the direct searches for the A prime. And the reason is that you get things like, you know, I produce 3 A primes, each of which decays to pairs of leptons. I get 6 leptons. That's a really weird signal. But it's something that just naturally emerges. So at the LHC, what could we look for? Well, the Z mixes with the dark photon, and then that dark photon can decay into dark photon, dark Higgs, and then this in turn decays to 2 dark photons. And it's proportional to the mixing squared and then also the dark coupling. So seeing something like this, it's very spectacular. We could, in principle, have 3 resonances of the A primes, these 2 combined to give the invariant mass of the dark Higgs. And it would provide a direct measurement of, you know, alpha dark, as well as, you know, prove that there was some dark mass generation mechanism. So these are perhaps discovery modes, but also, more importantly, tell information about what could be going on with these hidden sector particles. This is just an extremely simple example where you get Z to 6 leptons. But 90 GeV divided by 6 is not a lot of momentum for each lepton. And of course, it's not distributed symmetrically. So you can worry, how do you catch these leptons and what can you do? So what we did was we consider the case where each of the dark photons from the dark Higgs decays leptonically. So I have essentially a bunch of resonances here. And then I just don't really care about this one. And I rely on the fact that the backgrounds are still sufficiently low that I can get away with this. So basically, you're looking for kinematics where most of the transverse momentum goes into these leptons, and this is very soft. And then because these 4 leptons have to have a mass below the Z, we can veto any contributions at high invariant mass of the 4 leptons. The dominant background in this, from reinterpreting various low Matsuzzi searches, is actually electroreproduction of 4 leptons. And so basically what we did was we performed a resonance search in this 4-lepton mass. I didn't say we did. We proposed and did a case study of what you could do with this.
You don't have access to...
Well, I'll get to that in a moment, but more so, yeah. So this was the projected 95% confidence level sensitivity with 40 inverse femtobarns at 13 TeV. And it's sort of hard to see in this projector, but the best constraints come from LHCb, which is this green line. And then this is the projection for what you could do with different values of alpha dark. So you see that with alpha dark of 0.1 or higher, then you can actually do better with this search strategy. This is for dark Higgses of 20, 30, and 50. And this is just literally taking the cuts from the SUSY search and doing a resonant search in it. So this is something that's like feasible now. And actually, getting to Maxime's point, this is something that I had several students working on this summer. These are two very motivated freshmen. And they were able to figure out how to access CMS open data, including Monte Carlo. And we were able to assess selection efficiencies by comparing the reconstructed data to Monte Carlo and all kinds of stuff. It was fascinating, but we're sort of limited in terms of what we can actually get out of this data set. So we're currently working with CMS to figure out, like, this isn't quite at the level where we could publish the search. So what would we need to actually be able to do this? Because it's like, it's very close, actually. You can, the students rediscovered all the, dileptone resonances. They did a measurement of the zeta 4 lepton branching fraction. So a lot of stuff that you can do with this. And so it would be cool to see sort of some more tools provided to assess things like trigger efficiencies and whatnot that could get you a little bit closer to having a result that could be trusted. So what can we do in the future? Well, if we take projections for what you could do just from the direct production of the dark photon, this is for 3 inverse Addo-Barnes alpha dark of 0.1. So you see, once again, there's a prospect that this could be the dominant or the best way of discovering it, if you can actually keep the thresholds low. And so this motivates keeping like 4 lepton or 4 plus lepton multiplicities with load threshold as opposed to like 2 or 3 leptons. And part of our motivation for doing this is just that ATLAS had this wonderful 3 muon 7 GeV trigger. And it currently wasn't actually being used in any searches to our understanding. And so we wanted to make sure, no, you actually do real physics with these things. And once you go, of course, down below 10 GeV, you start getting into the range where the B factories are kind of winning. Oh, whoops. I don't know how that happened. OK. So this is for the case where you'll notice that that these curves are always such that the dark Higgs can decay into at least one on-shell dark photon. So for instance, this curve dies off as you, for 50 GeV, once you get around to 50 GeV dark photon masses. And the reason is that if both of these dark photons are off-shell for its decay, it can be long-lived. And it becomes a much more model-dependent question of, like, does this win out, for instance, over the Higgs mixing decay? And so, we kind of, depending on your choices of parameters, it either did or it didn't. And so instead, we try to take a more open-minded search here to say, like, let's say this thing does decay into two dark photons off-shell. Like, as a function of lifetime and the mass, what parts of the parameter space can we cover? So here, you actually do something that's a bit different, which before we had these decay leptonically. But now it makes more sense to have this dark photon decay leptonically. I have a prompt dilepton resonance, which I can trigger on the leptons. Then I have one displaced vertex that is either 4 leptons, 2 leptons, and some hadrons, or a bunch of hadrons. And so we used some kind of rough numbers from some ATLAS and CMS displaced vertex searches just to get a rough idea of where we could land if, say, we could have sensitivity to 10 signal events. And even if the backgrounds for this are reasonable, what's nice is that you can do a bump hunt in this lepton pair. So you can completely characterize what the backgrounds are in a data-driven way, rather than the usual problem of long-lived particle backgrounds. It's like God only knows what the background is. You see 2, is it 2 plus or minus 10 or 0.1? So what can you do? This is a plot that shows the kinetic mixing parameter. Here's the mass of the A prime. Here's the lifetime of the dark Higgs. We assumed some relationship between the masses and 0.1 alpha dark. This is with current or year ago luminosity at 13 TeV. These are sort of where the LHCb limits on the direct production are. And so you can see that a displaced vertex search in a signature like this would be very constraining over a wide variety of masses. And this is without imposing any invariant mass criteria on what the dark Higgs is or something. So this is an interesting way that we can kind of push at a frontier that this wouldn't be covered by any existing searches, but maybe could be by a variant of that. And this then drives a question on, like, what other gaps exist at the LHC. And basically, long-lived particle searches are hard to do, and they depend on detector effects in ways that other searches don't. Because if something decays to a muon, whether you see it as a muon depends on whether it decays in the tracker, the calorimeter, and the muon spectrometer, or wherever else. And basically, can therefore be hard to do the searches. There are weird backgrounds that it can also be hard to interpret the results of searches or to even know if your search has any sensitivity to your final state. So for instance, Atlas was doing a multi-jet resonance search and they said, well, we don't imply any requirement on the tracks pointing back to the primary vertex, and so it does have sensitivity to long-lived particles. Except then they actually passed a signal with long-lived particles through, and they found it had no sensitivity because they were applying a jet cleaning cut that implicitly imposed some track requirement on it. And just reading the paper, you would have no idea whether the search has any sensitivity to your model or not. And so it's really important to coordinate efforts to, you know, figure out what searches are important to cover the signature space, and then also to present the results in a way that is sufficiently clear that you can tell exactly what's going into the search, whether it's sensitive to long-lived particles or not. And so towards this effort, I'm co-leading the efforts for a white paper that's bringing together contributions from both the theory community as well as kind of main LHC experiments, as well as other proposed experiments for looking for long-lived particles in dedicated detectors. So this will hopefully be, we have a final draft that is currently in revision stage. It's a bit of a beast. It's like 250 pages long. But it covers a whole lot of things related to the tools you need to simulate the signals, to have some common basis, where the gaps at experimental coverage are and things that need to be done, what can we be doing with detector upgrades, how should we be presenting the results, and sort of future directions for even weirder signals than the ones we've been talking about. So to summarize, there's been a lot of progress in searches for hidden sectors over the past decade and a half. And I think it's important to keep in mind that even minor extensions of simplest hidden sectors can give totally uncovered regions of signature space. And so we want to make sure we're doing those searches. And we need to do them both at high and low energy experiments to cover all the gaps. But thank you.
Page report is covering only the existing experiments like Atlas, CMS, or LHCb, or?
So our scope has been defined as long-lived particles produced in PP collisions at LHC interaction points. So there are also contributions from like Metal, Methuselah, other proposals for new detectors to basically say, okay, like what is happening at the LHC? However, it does not include sort of NA62 Sequest ship, just because we kind of had to draw a line somewhere. And we kind of thought, okay, let's associate things with the actual LHC running. But I think that, you know, what PBC and other groups are trying to do then is to take these different kinds of projections and merge them together. But even accomplishing this has been like a beast of a thing to do. So we're kind of taking it one step at a time. I don't know if that was your question, but
yeah.
And I would say that in some sense, what people were most excited about was the upgrade discussions, but actually that's probably the least helpful part of, I mean, it's nice because it outlines the planned upgrades, but you know, basically only the experiments can do studies of what these detectors can do, and they have not made a lot of them public. And so we're kind of limited to talking about sort of hardware and, you know, maybe you could do this or maybe you could do that. So I think that's kind of an open next question is like, are there actual concrete things that you can do better with these upgraded detectors? And that's not clear, I would say. Another goal of this was that there's kind of this emerging number of people that want to work in long-lived particles. So we wanted to have something that was kind of an accessible introduction, because up until this point, it was like, you had to know the guy on CMS who worked on this search who could point you to some obscure document that probably you weren't allowed to see to extract some information. And we're trying to get it out in the open so that, you know, everyone can be aware of what's going on and work on it. Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you very much for having me.